my next speaker is someone that's been a friend of mine for many years. Peter Brimelow is currently a columnist for CBS MarketWatch. He's a former senior editor at Forbes. His new book is this one right here, called The Worm and the Apple, which I highly recommend to anyone here and beyond. Peter was born in England. He was educated at Sussex. He received his MBA in the Bay Area here from Stanford University. He's also been a media fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was a recipient of a Fulbright Award and also a Stanford Scholarship. He's received numerous awards, including the Royal Bank Toronto Press Club Award. He's also had quite an extensive career in the media. He was a staff writer for the Financial Post in Toronto, business editor at Maclean's, economic counsel for Senator Orrin Hatch, associate editor at Fortune, senior editor at National Review, contributing editor at Barron's, and so forth. He's the author of many other books, and his articles have appeared in many top newspapers and magazines. I'm very pleased to introduce Peter Brimelow.
Thank you, David. Thank you, John.
When do you want me to stop?
Half an hour. If you want to go to bed. Okay. You know, at the time of A Nation at Risk, which, as John mentioned, in 1983, I was at Fortune magazine. And they came to me. Fortune's kind of a top-down operation, and they came to me and said, we have to do something about what they call them public school, the public school crisis. I didn't call them government schools. We're trying to change this into government schools. They said, and you have to write the story. And so I said this was a very poor idea because I hadn't gone to an American school, obviously. And at that time, we didn't have children, so I had no first-hand experience. And finally, it was summer, and the school was shut. They replied, this will make you objective. And guess what? They were right. I approached the school system as a financial journalist would approach any industry, the baked bean industry. It doesn't make any difference. It's a question of input versus output. Which is what's the most effective use of output? What's the best output relative to what the input is? Now this is completely and totally antithetical to the way the education industry looks at itself, and for that matter, the way most education writers that write about their attitude is. Education is good, more education is better. Education spending is good, more education spending is better. They have no sense of marginal utility. Is that the term, John? Thank you. So when you look at since in the 20 years since Nation at Risk came out, you know, you can argue about the results, which are basically flat. The test scores, as far as we can tell, there's been no dramatic improvement since A Nation at Risk. But one thing you can't argue about is that the system is now fantastically more expensive than it was 20 years ago. Costs have gone up in real terms. Per pupil sort of spending has risen, adjusted for inflation, by something like 40%. There are various ways of measuring productivity. It's an interesting concept. The productivity is down 35 to 40% in the system in just 20 years. Now, this is unique in the American economy. There's no other area where you see this continuous productivity decline. There are never any productivity increases in education, in spite of typewriters, television, computers, and videos, which your children spend more time watching than you may think in public schools. There's never any productivity increases. So I find this an extremely arresting case. I may say, looking at John's book, by the way, the cases that he's citing, John's making the point that the experiments, and they are experiments that have been conducted in vouchers, you know, at the moment don't have clear results on the qualitative side as far as the quality of the testing, the output goes, except maybe for African Americans, there's some evidence it's helped them. But there's a secondary issue here, which is one of the principal points I'm making in my book, which is these experiments are cheaper. The kids are being turned out at lower cost, and that's an end in itself to me as a financial journalist. If you can get the cost down. But the problem, as soon as you look at the education system in this context, what you realize immediately, of course, is that we're looking at a socialist system, a socialist industry. With a fair amount of, I used to compare it to the Soviet farm system, you know, which for, as you know, turned Russia from being a grain exporter to being a grain importer, and experienced 70 years of bad weather at harvest time. Then the Soviet farm system went away. So we're left with the American school system, which is still very much here. And there are certain symptoms which you can always find. One of them is the politicized allocation of resources. John said, decisions about what's going to be spent on who is made through a political process, not through any kind of a market process. And that's a big problem in terms of efficiency. For example, generally speaking, for political reasons, we now mainstream handicapped children. That's fantastically expensive. It's responsible all by itself for about a third of the cost increase. And it's not clear that's the best use of resources. Or that it, for that matter, is best for the children. The second symptom of socialism is proliferating bureaucratic overhead. I have a lot of numbers about this in The Worm in the Apple. 50 years ago, there was three teachers in the school system for every one adult, every adult who wasn't a teacher. In other words, administrators, guidance counselors, whatever they are, who weren't in the classroom, there were three teachers. Now the ratio is almost 1-to-1. There's almost one non-teaching adult in the system for every teacher. There are about half a dozen states in the country where I find there are more adults out of the schools in the education system. They're in the central headquarters and so on. They never see a kid from one day's end to another because they're entirely in the headquarters. Another symptom of socialism, the third symptom, is the chronic mismatching of supply and demand. In this Russia, this used to take the form of the left boot factory producing more than the right boot factory did. In the teaching system, it gluts in various things, followed by shortages. We've had a teacher shortage, and there's some evidence now we're going to have a teacher glut in California. It's an endless cycle of chronic mismatching of supply and demand. A fourth symptom of socialism, which you're all familiar with, is the constant quest for top-down panaceas. There are no solutions coming up from the bottom, so solutions have to be imposed from the top. In the Soviet system, it took the form of plowing the virgin lands, or using more fertilizer, if preferably financed with Western bank loans, all this sort of thing. All these panaceas usually involve more input. In the American school system, the government school system, it takes the form of various fads that go through the system, such as whole language, or open classrooms, or closed classrooms, or just ajar classrooms, or any kind of classroom. There's endless series of fads like this. And this is inevitable in the system because that's the only way you can get any change. I have to say, I think the president's plan, No Child Left Behind, is in itself a type of a fad. It's equivalent to sort of going out and shooting a few peasants to make them work harder. And it will produce results in the short run. But in the long run, I don't think it is going to produce results. And the final symptom of socialism is qualitative and quantitative collapse, and that's what we see in the system, particularly on the quantitative side, on the cost side. This is my contribution to the school debate. We should be worrying more about cost. Forget about the output. Let's assume the output is constant. Let's just get the cost down. And if you're a California taxpayer, you're going to be thinking this a lot in the next little while, because basically, about half of local spending is the schools. And about 70% of that spending is teacher salaries. That's what's driving the budget crisis across the country. Now, having talked about the apple, the education system, I'm going to turn to the worm, the teachers union. The teacher unions. About 100 years ago, a number of muckraking journalists, on whom I model myself, made the discovery that there were these national corporations suddenly come into existence, and they were essentially acting like monopolies, and they were monopolies, Standoil and so on, and this was a bad thing. And they called them trusts. In those days, they used to call monopolies trusts. Now, what we have here is a teacher trust. The way the union works is it attempts to monopolize and restrict the supply of labor in order to get the prices up. The teacher trust. Now, it was said back in the 19th century, the tariff is the mother of trusts. Very important point. What it means is if you could get imports, cheap imports coming in, they would undermine any domestic monopoly. So it's a public policy that makes it possible for the trust to come into existence. Similarly, I think the government school system is itself the mother of the teacher trust. It's a political system, and it responds to political action, and that's what the teacher union is good at. It's important to realize this is new. The National Education Association has been around literally since the Civil War, 150 years or something. But it was literally a National Education Association for most of its existence. It only became a union in the 1960s. It was actually illegal for teachers for public employees generally to unionize until the 1960s. And the reason it was illegal is that even labor advocates like for FDR and George Meany at the AFL-CIO thought that it would simply create a situation of impossible power, that you have a monopoly on top of a monopoly. You'd have a monopoly supplier of labor to a monopoly service. In the case of education, there's actually a third level of monopoly, which is the compulsory attendance laws. The consumers are forced to consume. So that for that reason, that they felt that that public employee unions and particularly teacher unions were a bad idea, and they were right. It turns out that 30 years later, this has been a disaster. It's created a monster. But you know, this often happens in the economy. When you have a very dynamic and fluid but also structured system like the U.S. economy, it happens from time to time that some group gets itself in a position where it can, there's kind of an institutional glitch, and it can extort rents. How would you define rents, John? Basically, it's money. They can extort money from the rest of the system. Is there such a thing as an excess profit? Let's not get into that. I'm old enough to remember when this was the case with stockbrokers. Are there any stockbrokers in the room? You know, there was a time when you couldn't negotiate commission rates as a stockbroker. You didn't have as a buyer of stock. So these big institutions like insurance companies were buying these huge blocks of stock and paying retail commissions on them. So it made a lot of institutional salesmen very rich for a while until they were forced to start negotiating commissions. I would say another example before deregulation, airline deregulation. Another example I would say was the plaintiff lawyers right now. The interaction of contingency fees on the one hand and the tort crisis on the other, the liability crisis on the other, has made a lot of trial lawyers very rich. But the interesting thing about all these glitches is that eventually people figure out what's happening, they do something about it, and they go away. And that's what's going to happen with the teachers' union, the teacher trust. There was actually nothing inevitable about this development, that teachers would go to in a sort of industrial union model of organizing. And at the very moment that they did it, it turned out that the union movement was entering a historic decline. Fewer and fewer Americans are involved in unions in the private sector. It really is the public sector that's keeping the union movement going. And that's a big problem for the union right now, by the way. They're having trouble keeping their membership growing. And one of the reasons for it is that the Generation X simply can't relate to the idea of solidarity forever and all this stuff. They can't believe that some of the things that the union is supposed to be protecting them against, they just don't believe would ever happen. You know, there was a time, for example, when teachers, way back in the 40s and earlier, when teachers used to have to get permission to marry and things like that. Now, no Generation X can even believe this could exist. They think that's out of the Stone Age. So the union can't very well pretend that it's going to protect them against that. Marriage is the least of the things out there. Well, let's not get into that. the final point I'd like to make about the teacher union, the teacher trust, is it's absolutely critically dependent on legal privileges. It doesn't come into existence in a vacuum. Those legal privileges, I mean, the most important was to be allowed to unionize at all in the public sector. But basically, you could divide them into collective bargaining on the one hand, collective bargaining laws, and agency fee laws. A collective bargaining means that if you're a collective bargaining state, if you get enough teachers together, you can compel the school board to negotiate with you as the exclusive representative of all teachers. That's what collective bargaining is. You've got it in California. There's also agency fee. That means that once the teacher union has got itself recognized as the monopoly bargainer, it can then turn around and demand fees from even teachers who don't want to join the union. It can't compel them to join, but it can compel them to pay fees, except for some of the political contributions. That's called agency fee. You've got that in California too. In fact, it's mandatory in California. It's not even negotiable here. The CTA has got itself into a position of extraordinary power. But it's done it recently. When I came here in 1970, it wasn't the case. Jerry Brown was responsible for passing collective bargaining in the public school sector. And the result of all this is that the inmates are running the asylum. I have somewhere, there's a quote from... the Hoover Institution from Terry Moe. Where'd he go? About rules. Well, here's the one I used this morning. The California legislative analyst discussing the California situation. He said, districts that enter into collective bargaining share power with the unions over a wide range of decisions that affect district educational policies and the distribution of district resources. In other words, they just get control over every aspect of life. And the rules that they're using is simply pervasive. I won't bother with that right now. How we doing? Okay. Let me draw back a minute and raise another question about the education system. Apart from the cost numbers, which I think are really fascinating, there's another interesting number about the way in which the government school system works, which tells us a lot about what's going on, and that's the dropout rate, or more to the inverse of the dropout rate, is the graduation rate. Way back in 1900, about 5-6%. Of all 17-year-olds graduated from high school. It was very unusual to graduate from high school in those days. Most people dropped out, went to work. Even as late, then after that, it starts to go up, looking from left to right, an exponential curve. By the Second World War, about half of the kids in that group, 17-year-olds, were graduating from high school. But still, the fact is that Hitler was defeated by a nation of high school dropouts. The graduation rate continued to soar until 1968 or 69, and it reached 77%. And at that point, it stalled, and it's never gotten higher than that. 25 years later, it's actually significantly lower now. It's declined to below 70%, 68-67%. Now, this is a fascinating datum, I think, and it can only be explained in two ways. One is that there's something absolutely chronically wrong with the system because it can't do what it's trying to do, namely graduate all the kids from high school. Or the second possibility is that, in fact, the kids can't be graduated from high school. There's a limit to the number of people you can actually expect to graduate from high school. I have data in the Worm in the Apple, which says that suggests that in the early 1990s, of white kids with IQs below 75, nearly half of them were graduating from high school. Now, these kids are on the verge of being technically retarded, but they graduated from high school. What does this say about the high school degree? That's a really fascinating question to me. I mean, what it means is that there's never been a golden age of American education where everybody graduated from high school. The attempt to keep people in these big comprehensive high schools till they're 18 and get them out at 18 has never worked. It's responsible for a lot of curious things. I mean, occasionally you'll see people say that the quality of high schools was much better back in the 1900s and so on. That's probably true because the kids who were getting out of high school were an academic elite. They weren't attempting to keep all these other kids in the system and generally having them stink up the halls and have fights and all this sort of thing. But there's another side of this as well, by the way. A teacher once said to me that when he and I went through school 150 years ago, the big difference today, he said, with his kids was that kids are constantly falling asleep in class. And the reason they're falling asleep in class is they're working in the malls. The labor force participation of 16 to 19-year-olds for Americans is staggering. It's like 60%. It's three or four times what it is in France or Germany. Now, I think that's something it seems to me that's something that should be encouraged. They should be sent out there to work if they want to work, and maybe drop in and out of education later. Maybe we should focus on getting the kids out of school early with a basic education and allow them to come back and to top up later as they see fit. Now, that's exactly the kind of thinking that the teachers' union will not allow, because they want more victims in the system. They would like you all to be in high school right now. And there's another aspect of this, which is the homeschooling, great expansion in homeschooling. There's somewhere between 500,000 and 1.5 million kids being homeschooled at the moment. It's very hard to get exact numbers, but it's clearly vastly larger than it was 30 years ago. Now, that's come about because laws have been changed, which goes to the critical importance of the legal framework in the education system. Parents had to be given the right to educate those kids at schools at home and yet conform with the compulsory education laws that exist in every state. But the interesting thing is, and we were talking about this earlier, when you talk to homeschoolers, I mean, I have small children. It's impossible for me to imagine educating these two children at home without murdering them. Or in the case of teenagers, being murdered by them. But the answer is that they're not actually taught for very long. Homeschools make it work because they teach the kids for a couple of hours a day. In other words, the moral of the story is that the substantive content of education can be delivered much more efficiently, both in terms of the hours of the day and the years, probably the years in the in the school, the school kids' curriculum, than it is right now. Now, I'll quickly say something about what's to be done. I see two aspects to this problem. That's your book, isn't it? I'm sorry. One of them is we've got to clean the apple. The answer is clean the apple, market forces. There are lots of proposals. John's discussed a few. They're both an end and also a means because they undermine the power of the teachers' union. If it can't keep people marching in lockstep, and it doesn't like organizing lots of small units, its power is going to be weakened. But the second aspect of what's to be done is the worm itself has to be extracted and exterminated. That means the teacher trust has got to be busted. You've got to go to the legal framework that governs that in which the teacher trust is rooted. In the last chapter of Worm, I have about 25 proposals where this could be done, ranging from very grand ideas to small ones. For example, I don't see why you couldn't apply an antitrust theory to the teacher union, break it up into separate states so it can't mobilize across state lines. Curiously enough, that was one of the things the NEA actually did when it became a union, was to unify its dues to compel teachers everywhere who joined any branch of the NEA to join the national union. And it was very, very unpopular. In fact, the Missouri Teachers Union actually seceded from the NEA over it. But there's a lot of other things that can be done too. In the end, it goes down to the collective bargaining laws. The collective bargaining laws have got to be weakened, so that teachers don't have this, accept the leadership of the union. At least there's competition among representatives. In Texas, there's actually a profit-making organization that bargains on behalf of teachers. It happens that in North Carolina and Virginia, there are still two states in the union, North Carolina and Virginia, where school boards are prohibited from bargaining collectively. They're not allowed to bargain with teacher unions. Of course, you still have a socialist system, and the union still exists, and it confers and it lobbies and so on and so forth. And people in Virginia think it's very strong, but it's nowhere near as strong as it is here. And that's something which ought to be thought about. I want finally to say that someone was saying to me earlier, is there any hope for the system? It seems to me there's a lot of hope. I mean, this is not a stable system. It's something that's happened by accident. It can be swept away. And if you have any doubts about it, tell you a story. In the town in Connecticut where I live, there was an attempt recently they had a lot of trouble getting the peasants to vote for a tax increase, and so it kept getting voted down. And at one point, the teachers actually picketed the commuting drivers, and they had big notices up, holding up, saying, it's about the children. Now, of course, it's not about the children, it's about the teachers. Any teachers who don't realize they belong to a union, by the way, Paul show. And the grander reason I would adduce for being hopeful is, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed. Thanks very much.